What is Maine? Who is Maine? What are the stories of those who have lived here from the beginning, that migrated here, and that continue to inhabit this unique place? These are conversations from the Pointed Firs, invoking the spirit of place with artists and authors from Maine.
Welcome to Conversations from the Pointed Firs. I'm your host, Peter Neal. My guest today is Siri Beckman, woodcut artist from Bath, Maine, whose unique works are collected in a new publication, Engraving a Sense of Place, The Prints of Siri Beckman, recently published by Down East Books. Siri, welcome.
Hello. Nice to be here.
It's great to see you. Great to meet you at long last. In my office, I have three or four prints. We've bought several and given them as gifts to important people we love. So I was familiar with your work before we met. Now I get the best of both worlds.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me to do this. And as you were reading that, I was thinking to myself that when I was working on many of these blocks, WERU was my constant companion.
There you go. Well, let's begin at the beginning. I usually start with kind of historical inquiry, where you came from. Are you from Maine originally? How you got here, if not? How did it all begin?
Well, I grew up in the Midwest, actually in the Chicago area. And I married after college and lived in Cincinnati, Ohio for about 10 years. And when my marriage came to an end, I had to move into an apartment. And my next door neighbor turned out to be a woman whose mother had a business in Deer Isle, Maine, which I had never heard of. And my job at that time was working in the Cincinnati Public Library. And so I used to spend any spare time I had just walking around the stacks. And lo and behold, I came upon Elliot Porter's Summer Island. And I looked at the opening pictures, which were black and white photos of Stonington, and I was just struck by the beauty, and I thought, I have got to see this place. So I decided that I would make a trip. Originally, my friend neighbor was going to go with me, but then could not join me because of work schedules. And so I decided I would make the trip by myself. So that was the longest car trip I had certainly ever taken.
When was this?
1975.
Uh-huh. Another corn-fed migrant.
Right.
West to east. I'm one, too. And what did you find when you got here?
Well, my goodness, I found this beautiful island surrounded by the ocean. My friend's mother let me use a cottage that she leased that was literally had a view over Sand Beach and was surrounded by Rugosa roses. I mean, what more could you ask for?
You're gone to heaven. Is it possible that you had never seen the ocean before you arrived in Stonington?
Actually, I had seen the ocean because my parents took us on a vacation. We went to Cape Cod. Mm. So that was really my only view of the ocean.
Mm-hmm. You saw it. You were struck dumb by the beauty. So did you act precipitously?
Yes, I guess I did, because after my two-week vacation, towards the end of it, I had already found an apartment to rent. And so I told them I'd be back in a month. So I went back to Cincinnati. I sold most of my belongings, took a few things I could cram into a Pinto station wagon, and made the return journey. And I think, if I remember, I showed up about October 1st.
Mm, fall.
Fall, yeah.
Mm, beautiful. Right. And you had your apartment waiting. You had a Pinto full of possessions, and that's all you needed.
Yeah.
So you were a Mainer the minute you stepped out of your car. You'd left all the corn and wide open spaces behind and found another wide open space
in
the Gulf of Maine.
Not exactly, because if you move to a small community like Stonington in October, they know that you are from someplace else. Mm.
Well, they've just seen all the other people from someplace else up and leave.
That's right.
So it's very confusing for them.
So I stuck out. I stuck out because of my accent. Mm. And I had one funny incident when I was in the grocery store, and I was talking to somebody next to me, and this little girl looked up at me, and she said, "You know, you talk funny."
Right.
And I'm afraid that Midwestern accent is still with me.
Well, it's a curse we all have, but that's all right. We don't really completely abandon our roots.
No, right.
People do work at it, however. And there's nothing like a kind of immersion in the Burnt Cove market to sort of set you straight and
yes,
get you
right.
culturally aligned.
And I lived about a quarter of a mile from the market, so mm-hmm. I was very familiar with what we called the Burnt Cove accent.
Right. Which is different from any other accent on the island, I suspect.
Yeah.
Did you know you were an artist at
yes,
that time?
You did. Yes.
And
yes.
Had you been making art when you were in Cincinnati and working in the library?
Yes. Actually, I would say that I always was sort of marked, you might say, as an artistic child. And so art was always part of my life, even in high school. I occasionally would do portraits, but I would do... Oh, if there was a big dance or something, I would do wall murals and a lot of different things like that. Mm-hmm. And then when I moved to Cincinnati, my jobs were in the field of graphic arts. So sometimes it involved drawing, but sometimes it was just mechanical work. But my last job at the Cincinnati Public Library, I actually was able to do quite a lot of drawings for various publications.
Mm. Your parents welcomed your artistic bent?
They did, because my father was an artist.
Ah, would you tell me about that?
So my dad was what they called at the time a commercial artist, and he worked for the Crailer Furniture Company. And his job was to do black and white pen and ink illustrations for all of their newspaper advertising. And he did that his whole lifetime.
Amazing.
Now, on the side, he liked to paint. And we often would go to art galleries for shows or maybe the art museum.
So you were acculturated. It was okay for you to be an artist.
Yeah.
Good. And then why did you married and then you moved to Cincinnati following a man, no doubt.
Well, actually, I met him in Chicago.
You met him in Chicago.
He became, he was a graduate student at the University of Cincinnati mm-hmm. in political science.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, God bless. What was the first time you understood or picked up a block and an awl and started to make marks in wood?
That was a kind of an interesting story in itself. So when I moved to the island, first of all, one of the chapters that isn't mentioned in the book here is the fact that I bought fairly quickly. I found an acreage, 18 acres of woods in Stonington outside the village. And I bought it at the time, 1975. It cost me $4,000. Mm. And I had this idea that I wanted to build a house. There was, you know, plenty of people who did all kinds of work in my immediate neighborhood, really. There literally was a sawmill right down the road. So I had somebody cut the trees down, take them to the mill, and saw them into building material. And so that was one thing that preoccupied me quite a bit in the early days. And during that time, I took all kinds of different jobs. I worked at the island newspaper for a while. I would do any kind of art job. You know, I would paint people's cottages. I would do logos for different people. I produced a bunch of note cards. So then the other wonderful thing that happened was that a group of us formed an art cooperative. So that gave me a group of people that became my friends right off the bat. And we ran that cooperative business for 10 years.
What was it called?
Well, that was kind of interesting. The first name we gave it was Some Stuff. And
not particularly the best marketing I can think of. But
I'll have to say there was a very talented sign maker in town, and he made a beautiful, beautiful sign. Mm-hmm. But later on, the name was changed to, I think it was Eastern Bay Gallery. But to go back to your original question, during that time when I took all sorts of jobs, one of them was with a woman whose husband had been quite a well-known illustrator, kind of in the Norman Rockwell vein and era. So he had passed away, and he had left behind literally hundreds of watercolor illustrations. She hired me to just help her sort through things. So I did, but at the end, we came across actually some wood engraving tools and some blocks. So he had also tried wood engraving himself. And when I expressed interest in them, she gave them to me along with a book that was published in 1935, I think, which was filled with wood engravings. Mm-hmm. I had never really seen wood engravings before, but I was struck by the medium, and there I was. I had a book, tools, and a block. So that's how I started.
When you look through that book, which I assume was a kind of catalog of other people's work, did people jump out to you as mentors whose work or style you admired?
You know, the book itself was interesting because it contained the wood engravings from not just the U.S., but also Europe and Russia. It was a huge range of styles and subject matter. So I'm not sure the book itself had that much influence on me other than my fascination with the technique. But what I started to do was to look for people around New England who might be wood engravers who I could actually have, you know, face-to-face contact with. And I went down to Boston in search of Barry Mosier one time because he was such a prominent personality at that time and still is. And I was intrigued by his incredible detailed style that he had. But then I also discovered that there was somebody right here in Stockton Springs, Tony Kulik. So he was a wood engraver right here in Maine. And I used to see him off and on at the Common Ground Fair. So those people probably the American wood engravers that I slowly discovered. And actually, there is an organization called the Wood Engravers Network that I belonged to in the early days that is still going and still very active. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, I'm going to say the bulk of them are in the Midwest.
Well, it's interesting. That's true in letterpress as well. There were all these small letterpresses all through the Midwest before it came back and became a kind of Eastern and cultural appropriation. I remember the first time I saw a Barry Mosier engraving, and they were detailed, but they were bold. He was not a man who held back. And the medium suits. I mean, it can be bold and direct, but then it can be so subtle and refined. So you had the tools, you had the blocks. When did you dare to scratch at one?
Let's see, I was going to say one more thing about people that I met. The other person was Leonard Baskin, because Leonard Baskin had a summer home on Deer Isle. And one of the many jobs that I had was picture framing, which I actually did for 15 years. And I met Leonard Baskin when he came into my frame shop to have something framed that was a painting by Jill Hoy, who lives on the island. And he saw one of my wood engravings, and he said, "Oh, I see you use the white line technique," in a rather haughty manner.
Haughty, yeah.
So that was my other encounter.
Well, little did you know that you had been visited by a cardinal. He just wasn't in his red gown. But the fact was he couldn't abandon his haughty behavior. But nonetheless, another great one. I mean,
yeah,
I mean,
right.
These are all worthy mentors, yeah. Direct or indirect.
Right.
That's fantastic. So did you adopt the white line? You did. You started with the white line technique, whatever that
means.
Well,
yes, and I mean, frankly, I had to look at it carefully to understand exactly what he meant by white line technique. But if you think about it, basically you're cutting a white line into the block because you put ink on the surface. So the surface prints black, and those lines that you've cut into it are your white background coming through.
So there's a distinction here between a wood block and an engraving stone.
So the blocks are engraving blocks. If you bring in the word stone, you're sort of implying lithography, mm-hmm. which is a chemical process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I just revealed my ignorance. So what was the first piece? Can you remember?
Let's see. It's the one in the book. One of the very early ones was actually a picture of, it's one of the few things in those days that I did that were actually color. But it was, let's see if I can find
Three Friends.
Well, one early one was the one called Phosphorescence.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
On page, looks like 14. Mm-hmm. That was an early one. And most of the engravings started as personal experience.
And this is of you sailing off of the island, no doubt. It seems like it's in moonlight. There's phosphorescence in the
right.
ocean water, moonlight on the waterscape, and a very complicated complexity of cloud sort of half covering the moon, full moon. It's really beautiful piece, and there's an older man at the helm and what seems like a young woman dragging her fingers in the water.
I guess it does look like an older man.
Was it not? Anyway.
Must have been the moonlight on blonde hair.
Yes,
I don't know.
Exactly. Anyway, this is the difficulty, listeners, of us trying to talk about something that you cannot see. Go and find out is go find the book. Engraving a sense of place.
So if you go over to page 19, this one also is an early one, and it shows... I used sort of a soft yellow to pale pink background color and then printed the dark brown over that. But that is basically my little house in the woods with me out there trying to split a big piece of wood and my dog Blackberry.
And the smoke curling out of the wood
stove
chimney.
Right, the smoke curling out of the chimney.
It's interesting, even though it seems yellow, slightly reddish pink, it feels cold.
Yeah.
It feels very cold.
Yeah.
This is Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a monthly interview program with authors, artists, and exemplars who evoke the spirit of Maine. Broadcast the first Friday of every month here on WERU Community Radio, 89.9 FM, streaming online and archived at weru.org and available as podcast at pointedfirs.org. I'm speaking today with Siri Beckman, wood engraver and keen observer of quiet, dissolute moments of life in Maine. Were you lonely out there in that house, or did you have so much social activity in the town that
you know, actually, I really would never say that I was lonely, partly because I was very engaged in the community. You know, I served on a variety of committees, town committees. And I was on the Volunteer Ambulance Corps. And then I had this group in the co-op, the art co-op. So, yeah, I was always very engaged in the community.
I think that when I turn these pages through, what strikes me most are these the scenes, the sort of iconic scenes that you have picked. They become very individualized and personal, but at the same time, they sort of are archetypal. I mean, the island dance, for example, is one.
Right.
Another one, which I like right early on in the book, is Clammers. And it's not, of course, Clammers out in the flats. It's Clammers in the local.
It's Clammers at the Bayview restaurant.
And you know, they're sitting there with their boots turned down and a hot cup of coffee, and it's early morning. It just captures that. And even there's a reflection in a mirror behind that sort of shows the other side of the two people, the waitress and the customer. And it's just one of those intimate things that happen in small towns that in and of themselves are one thing, but then you pull them out, you put them into a work of art, and they become something quite other.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite places to go for breakfast. And I usually, whenever I went any place, I would take my sketchbook with me. So I could quietly sit in a booth and draw the various people who came into the restaurant. And all of that became material for my wood engravings, as did the other one on the other side, the facing page of that one. That's the same restaurant, but a different view through the windows.
With the dog waiting patiently
outdoors. Right, that is my friend Larry's dog sitting out there. Now, actually, those two together give you a good comparison for the difference between a linoleum cut and a wood engraving.
So talk about that a little bit.
It might be a little hard to describe verbally, but I think you can see the differences. A lino cut is much simpler in design, and it has large areas of black, white, and when you create a tone, you basically have to cut small lines with varying widths. But linoleum cuts tend to be bolder, where the other one, the wood engraving, you can see is composed of all those very, very, very fine lines that create gray textures.
And that's just a function of the properties of the block.
Right. So the wood, you can do that, and the tool, not just the material, but also the tools. So with the wood engraving, you've got this very, very hard wood block that has extremely close together grain. Sometimes you can't even see it. So you can cut many, many lines, many, many very fine lines, and they will hold up under the pressure of the press. Whereas the linoleum, it's a soft material. You can use bigger, broader tools.
But do you make the decision at the beginning just because you have one or the other in front of you, or do you choose one depending on the image that you have in your mind?
Well, I tended to do more wood engraving than lino cut, but one reason I might choose linoleum or lino cut would be scale. Even in these two, the scale is different. The one called Tony is about 5x5, whereas the other one called Clammers is 5x7. But even that additional 2 inches would have been hours and hours of more work, actually, when you think about it. Mm-hmm. So if I was going to do something on a big scale, I would use linoleum because that you can actually buy in a roll that's 3 feet wide, and you can do something very large.
Well, there's also, even though these are more or less the same, they're only 2 inches different in one diameter between the two of them. The lino cut is simpler and bolder. I confess I associate your style, and I think your work is at its finest, with these wood engravings, which have not only this essential detail that's in there. You can see the eyebrows on Tony's dog.
Right.
but they are, somehow it just seems to me that they are a little bit, but the complexity makes them simpler in some ways, and certainly more evocative, I think. I just think there's a kind of an emotional feeling between the two that's palpable and consistent all the way through. When you look at some of the later ones where you're doing, there's one called Hearts, Buttons, and Fish, which is basically a bouquet that's coming out of a fish's mouth. And it's incredibly beautiful in terms of its composition. But if you look at the lining of it, the fish scales or the stamens and petals of the flowers, I mean, it's truly intricate and shocking in a way. It's confusing to look at. It's a very abstract, very modern work.
Thank you.
Another one here is Juncos. In terms of up close relationship between with natural phenomenon, you get the detail and the complexity, which is really quite wonderful. How did you decide? I mean, there's so many of these scenes that are they imaginary, or are these things that were suggested by? So one's called Hanging the Bedding, and it's hanging the bedding out to dry or air inside the house. Flowers on the tables. The windows are open. Wonderful figure with trying to put the quilt over the top of the line. Is that you? Is that a scene that you saw somewhere else? Is that
no? That is actually an illustration that I did for a book called A Week at the Lake, and I had a gallery dealer whose name was Nan Mulford. She was located in Rockport and then Rockland, but she exhibited my work for 10 years. But she had come across a diary written by her mother, and it ended up forming a story about a week at Lake Wittipitlock, which is kind of up near Baxter State Park. Because I had just gotten this letterpress equipment, I told her I would be interested in using it in creating a letterpress hand-bound book. And so I did the wood engravings as the illustrations, and that was one of them.
Where did you find your press? Where did you find your monotype?
The press, interestingly, came from North Adams, Massachusetts. And it turned out that it had at one time belonged to the man whose name I've forgotten who did printing for Barry Mosher. And so,
it was meant to be.
When I got out of graduate school in, I think it was 1990, I went to graduate school in Philadelphia, University of the Arts, in book arts and printmaking. When I graduated, I came back to Maine and was offered a six-month job with Scott Vile of the Ascensius Press in Portland. And he had a huge letterpress shop. And so he was the one that found the press for me.
Did you acquire that press?
Yeah.
Have it?
No. Unfortunately, when I moved to Bath, there was no way I was going to be able to move a 1,200-pound press into my second floor apartment.
The neighbors below might be not only worried by the sound, but by the creaking of the rafters. Right. Where do you go now to have work printed?
Well, that's what I'm trying to come to terms with, because I would like to be able to continue printing some of the blocks. Most of the blocks, I've only printed a portion of the edition. So I typically would limit the editions to 100 prints, and I would print 20 or 25 at a time just to cut down on the storage problem. So there are many of them that I could continue to print until I get to the end of the edition, and where to do that is what I'm trying to figure out. But I think maybe two possibilities that I have right now. One is Maine Media in Rockport. And the other is Carter Chappie, who's got a nice little print shop in the Running with Scissors building down in Portland.
I've discovered accidentally a whole series of these small shops, small presses scattered through Maine. Are you aware of them and that history? When you emerged in this medium, did you suddenly find that you had brothers and sisters across the state?
In some respects, Well, you know, I was also part of a co-op in Bangor at that same time I was in the co-op in Stonington. I was just trying to think if there was any letterpress people.
Well, poets are notorious letterpress people. I mean, there's a kind of tradition, noble tradition of poets printing their own chapbooks and all the rest. And for example, my friend Beatrice Gates is a poet, well-known poet, and she started out printing her own chapbooks in a small wooden cannery in Brooksville. And I'm sure that there were others across the state. It's something I'd like to look into, actually. It would be a nice little history.
Let's see. One person I did meet was Kate Barnes, who was the poet laureate in Maine for a while, mm-hmm. because I did one of the wood engravings for a cover of her book of poems. It was published by Gary Lawless of Gulf of Maine Books.
Well, we just had an interview with Gary Lawless.
Oh, nice.
He was wonderful.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah, he's got a lot of stories to tell.
He has many, many stories. Oh, gosh. A hard act to follow, I might add.
Yes.
Gary
and I are going to do a book signing event down at Thomas Mosher Showroom in Freeport. And so he's going to bring my book, and I'll sign them. And we're doing it in conjunction with Carl and David Little, whose book is finally out, the one called Art of the Penobscot Bay. So there'll essentially be the four of us there.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, so right. That should be fun.
Right. I want to go back to the archetypes, though, because when you look through here, I'm just going to go through here. So Seaside Chapel. Geometric, abstract, from the inside of an old church looking out. Fireflies, last light over buildings and probably Stonington.
Right.
Moonlit islands, harmonica player. Two girls sitting on the dock looking at an evening landscape across the water to a light on in a distant cottage.
Right. Now, that one actually was from a book that I did.
Here's another one, Fisherman's Wife. Aside, always forgotten, when we talk about the sort of the archetypal activity of Maine, there's the fisherman, even today, the fisherman, the lobsterman's wife, who, by the way, keeps the books.
Right. Now, that was my neighbor. They lived right down the street, and that was Mrs. Hardy. And a little further back in the woodcut section, you'll see a woodcut I did of Winslow Hardy. So these were people that I would see on a weekly basis. I often walked to the grocery store, which was about a quarter of a mile, and I would pass their house. And I would always observe, there he is right there, Winslow Hardy. Mm-hmm. I would observe their activities. And Winslow was known for his great strength.
Look at his arm. He's got an arm like a tree trunk. Gnarly.
So I had a very up close experience with Winslow when he was out cutting wood in his woods with his chainsaw, and it kicked back on him and hit him in the jaw.
Oh.
And because I was on the ambulance corps, I was in the back when we transported him to, we probably had to go to Ellsworth. And I couldn't get over it. He was able to talk the entire trip.
Had stories to tell.
He did.
Can't stop telling the stories.
No.
There's one here that I really wish I owned this one, actually. It's called Spring Morning. And it's a really interesting geometry of rooftops.
Right, so that's Stonington.
Yeah, Stonington rooftops, and you can kind of see the fish weir in the distance. And a neighbor is standing out on his stoop. There is I think it's a sheep, there's a ram there.
Yeah.
And he's looking up at the sun, and it's just the morning sun is coming across. He's looking up in a kind of really kind of spiritual, regenerative way, taking the sun in the morning, very meditative, really a powerful kind of image of a spiritual connection.
Right. So that was a man named Cary Holland, who was a Stonington character, you might say, who was involved in fishing, all kind, you know, probably clam digging, fishing, lived in that tiny little house right up in back of the public library, actually.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that I find really amazing about the juxtaposition between the fine line and scale in this work is how you can use the line to provide the detail, and you can use the paper, even when it's small, to make a great big rendering of a big subject. The one I'm looking at, actually, I have in my office, is mm-hmm. called Cod Fishing. And it's basically 3 by 4 inches vertical. And it's a trawler, old style, mm-hmm. morning light, birds around, and a very deep, deep net full of cod. And the boat's leaning on the weight, and the men are hauling on the net. And yet this is 2 by 3 inches. It's this tiny little thing, but the image itself is enormous.
Right, yeah. It shows the big picture in a very small format.
Right. Big picture including, you have the sort of ethereal, the heavens,
the morning sky,
and then you have the profundity of the deep, dark
right.
Ocean with a few lucky cod that didn't get caught in the net.
Right.
they may be the only ones left, but at the same time, it's just an amazing capacity or utility within the art form itself to capture that kind of scale. You can't really do it with a watercolor, I don't think. Very hard.
I think you might be right, and I guess it's because of the wood engraving medium itself. You can portray something fairly complex in a small space because you're really only dealing with the black line and how you use it. So it's all about the whites, the darks, and the grays.
There's some religious images as well in your catalog.
Was the one that's called St. Brendan Arrives in Stonington.
Right. That's the one I was thinking of.
Right. So I belong to the St. Brendan's Episcopal Church for many years. So I did that. At first I did it just kind of with a sense of humor, the idea that he actually may have come into the Stonington Harbor, which, I mean, the theory is he did arrive in North America, but chances are it was probably up in Newfoundland. So I just did it really as sort of a humorous thing. And, of course, the congregation loved it.
Well, I loved it, too. It's we actually have our copy mounted on the bulkhead of our sailboat, so we have taken it as a good luck charm.
Yes, you could, you know, I mean, think of what St. Brendan and his 12 or 13 monks did,
right,
by traveling from Scotland or Ireland, I've forgotten which, across the North Atlantic.
They parsed one part of the world fairly thoroughly and
right.
early, right. You have to take your hat off to them. You know, I once had the privilege of sailing on a Viking replica ship along the coast of Norway, and you know, the big sail, the single oar for steering,
wow.
open boat, no lights on the shore, moonlight. There was a kind of transcendent moment, and all those tough old Norwegians that had invited me along were in tears, as was I. It was one of these amazingly beautiful moments. But I also kept thinking how extraordinary it was that these people didn't just stay coastwise. They turned west, and then they just sailed out into nowhere between the islands and left Norway behind. And lo and behold, there was Greenland, or there was Maine.
Yeah.
And why not? Part of what we talk about here is this idea of the spirit of Maine. And I ask everyone, you know, what do you think that is? And how has it, if it has at all, informed your work, your choice of subject, even the medium that you use?
Well, clearly it informed my subject matter because I loved where I lived. I loved the island. And really, most of these things are based in personal experience. So it certainly informed my subject matter. If you think about it, I came from the Midwest, much of which is flat farmland, to this little island, and I was surrounded by woods constantly. So, of course, I loved wood. So why not wood cuts? It just seemed like the obvious thing to do. Well, wood, it's a wonderful material, and I still love wood.
And I may call these iconic images, but they were all outside your front door, like the man was stepping out on his stoop and looking at the sun, or the girls on the dock. You saw those things almost every day.
Right.
And I say, well, they're archetypes. Well, and that's exactly how archetypes are made, that they are sort of the amplification of familiar scenes that rise to a larger, higher level of meaning. It's a very ephemeral thing, this idea of spirit of place. But your book says that you're engraving a sense of place.
Yeah.
That's what's advertised here.
Right.
And I'm trying to get to the idea of how can you articulate that sense? You have done it in images. Is it possible to do it in words from a kind of personal statement? This is Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a monthly interview program with authors, artists, and exemplars who evoke the spirit of Maine. Broadcast the first Friday of every month here on WERU Community Radio, 89.9 FM, streaming online and archived at weru.org and available as podcast at pointedfirs.org. I'm speaking today with Siri Beckman, wood engraver and keen observer of quiet, dissolute moments of life in Maine.
Well, remember what you just said, engraving a sense of place. That's how I create the sense of place for myself, is to engrave it. So actually, when I'm engraving something, you could say that I'm creating something that was memorable for me, even if it was just a very common walking by my neighbor and observing their daily routine, or a particularly beautiful moment down at Sand Beach, or maybe sailing with a friend. All of those things are absorbed on a daily basis. And when I sit down to do a block, it enables me to express that feeling through my prints. A lot of people have told me what they like about the work is that it has, it always seems to strike people as having a lot of emotional content. So at first when I heard that, I thought, oh, well, But I think that the truth of it is it has that content because I really am putting everything in my experience into these prints.
Yeah, we have the phrase, the mind's eye. And that's what I see here, is that you're essentially, there are moments when your mind's eye records a scene. And you're able, through art and through this very tactile engagement between your hand and something as primitive or fundamental as a block of wood, to duplicate that, replicate that, and infuse it with your own sensibility, which makes it more than just a document. And I think that's what we are trying to capture in all these interviews, is how many different ways there are to translate the place we live into our mind's eye and engrave it on our memories. And then by our outward expression, to share it with our neighbors.
Yeah.
And there's one here which I also love called Moon Song. And it reminds me of my late, demented, cherished pet, Boxy, the water dog.
That's my dog, Blackberry.
Well, Blackberry is sitting on a rock in full coat. Again, it's the moonlight. the black and white of the engravings of the woodcuts. Mm-hmm. I mean, the wood engravings serves, and the moonlight is reflected in the patterns of his furs, and his head is up, and he's baying at the moon. And either it's a statement of sheer and utter joy, or one of the great cries out of anxiety and fear. And what am I doing here? And what's to be made of all this? It's absolutely a delightful print. And here again, there's so much emotion in that, in something that is a deep and private moment for a dog.
Yes, definitely. He loved to howl.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You never totally knew what was motivating it, but every once in a while he'd just sit down and howl.
Right, right. Well, who was the therapist that we all had to sit around and scream and howl at the moon, and that would release all the anxiety? Well,
same thing.
Blackberry did fine. This is really great. I actually, you went and you spent some time out in the West.
Right.
And there's a section in here of the Grand Canyon experience. It's interesting to me. These are very different, for the most part, very different scapes, landscapes. They're very, very big. I mean, this one called Grand Canyon Hughes, which is in color, 2011, it's 13 by 10. So it's a small work.
Yeah.
But it is a huge scape of butte and valley and crevasse and the geology of the time, of the place.
And that is a multicolored wood cut.
Right. I get lost in them. I don't get – here's another one, the Badlands. There are two on the Badlands. And they're just as detailed, and the skill is there. But for me, I think it's just that the openness of the space, as opposed to sort of the more enclosed, light-deprived place where we live.
You're speaking of New England?
Yes. It's just well-suited to the media.
Yeah, like, for example, the one on your right there, which is Mount Robson Provincial Park in Canada. I have little bits of narrative that go along with these that are in the book. So that one in particular, a friend and I hiked really quite a long ways in a miserable rainy afternoon, arriving at this incredible lake that was the color of sort of milky cerulean blue. And we set up our tents because we knew dark was coming, and it looked like it was stormy. Those beautiful peaks were completely covered by cloud. But at some point in the night, I got up to see, I felt the weather was changing. I got up in the night and I got out of the tent and just looked at the lake and the mountains. And the mountains had cleared of cloud, and we realized that we were in this valley with huge mountains on either side of it. So it was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Yet it's a small print.
Yeah. It's there. That vastness is there if you look at it. But then on the facing page, you have a woman sitting on a crude table in Mesa Verde National Park called Quiet Day.
Right.
And the addition of the human figure, the sort of the loneliness of it is an interesting juxtaposition between the two views.
So that little building is what they call a hogan.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a community of hogans. There was actually 9 hogans in this area. They were originally built for the Native American workers when it became a national park, and they had to spend so much time unearthing all of those ancient monuments. So it took them a long time before they could even advertise it as a national park experience, because it took a long time just to resurrect the place. It was actually that living in that little hogan was one of the most comforting experiences I think I ever had in a national park.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of the space.
Mm-hmm.
There was something about it that was very quiet, relaxing, and you felt contained in this sort of comforting world.
I feel that way in Pueblo architecture a lot.
Uh-huh.
Even when there's a larger one like Mesa Verde, empty now, you visit it as a solo visitor. You imagine that it was populated, but it still doesn't seem oppressive. It seems communal.
Mm-hmm.
And even that, this particular one, the Hogan, having been occupied by the workers who were actually involved in the sort of the archaeological recovery of their ancestors,
right.
It's embracing. I can see it. One more thing, which as I look at these, thumbing through this book, and I urge everybody to find a print first, buy the book second, but is shadow. It's a perfect medium for shadow.
Yeah.
And so even in the daylight, the shadow parts are really strong. And, you know, it's harder to do, say, with watercolor, to put a shadow of a tree, a reflection, a moon shadow, for example. You have to be really very good at it if you're going to try to get that in watercolor. You have to be good at it here, too. But the medium is perfect for it.
Yeah.
So that you're able to see the reflection of things or the shadows of things in a way that's very precise.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very evocative. So you're still working?
Yes, although I'll have to say, actually, this was my last wood engraving right here, the strawberry pickers.
And what was the date?
2018, I think.
Mm-hmm. And was that because you were moving?
I moved at the end of 2017. Mm-hmm. So that next year, I did that block mainly because it was a very different landscape down there. But one thing they do have is they have a wealth of fruit farmers, strawberries, huge fields of strawberries. There's a wonderful high bush blueberry picking farm. And so I explored all of those things. But the strawberry picking was, I think, one of my favorites. So I had to do this little block of strawberry picking.
2018.
Just before COVID.
Yes. And although some artists came alive in COVID because there was nothing to distract them from the studio.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Do you have another exhibit coming?
Yes. I have one in May in the Courthouse Gallery in Ellsworth, which will be combined with an exhibit of prints and a book signing.
Mm-hmm.
And then a very similar event at the Turtle Gallery in Deer Isle. And then I'm also going to do a book signing and a little talk at the Stonington Library.
Mm-hmm. I guess where I'm getting at, we can't stop working, can we?
No. And so what I've been doing lately, since I moved, is oil painting.
Really?
Yeah. I'm part of a cooperative studio in Bath over Rennie's on Front Street.
Mm-hmm.
We've got 6 people in our group. And all of us are, for the most part, painters at the moment. Although we do have a small etching press.
And when will we see these, the paintings?
That's hard to say. Usually what we do is we have open houses maybe 3 or 4 times a year, and people can come up because it doesn't have a street front.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go up a flight and a half of steps.
Mm-hmm.
And so we usually just have open houses to encourage people to come up.
So your move from the island to the big city has been successful?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, mm-hmm. I feel like it was a good decision.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you, Siri. This has been entertaining always.
I'm very
glad to meet you. We have not met before, mm-hmm. even though I'm surrounded by these images that haunt me. We'll be at the galleries this summer and look forward to seeing your work as it continues.
Yeah, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Conversations from the Pointed Firs. My guest today has been Siri Beckman, woodcut artist, whose new book, Engraving a Sense of Place, The Prints of Siri Beckman, has recently been published by Down East Books. My guest next time will be Lucas St. Clair, conservationist, philanthropist, and chair of the Elliottsville Foundation, that in 2016 donated 89,000 acres of Maine wilderness to the U.S. National Park Service as the core of the new Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument, a major expansion and commitment to the protection of Maine's unique natural and cultural landscape and to the conservation, recreation-based development of the region. This has been Conversations from the Pointed Firs. I'm your host, Peter Neal. Thanks for listening. Sarah Orne Jewett published her American classic, The Country of the Pointed Firs, in 1896, and it has remained a quiet evocation of the best of Maine. In a special edition published by Simon & Schuster, it is described as follows. It tells the story spanning 3 months' time in the life of a small coastal town called Dunnet Landing in 19th century Maine. A lone female visitor arrives and finds lodging with the widowed Mrs. Todd, the town herbalist, who introduces the visitor to many of the town's inhabitants. The visitor's impressions of the people she meets start out simply, and then almost invisibly they crescendo into a deep, intense human portrait. When I read this book, I am moved by the wisdom hidden in the simplicity of the story. The portraits of the people, the likes of whom are today my friends and neighbors, known and unknown. For Jewett, the place described is a best scape for living, in nature, at work, for community. It is a place to see, hear, smell, taste, feel, love, and celebrate the best of what we call home. At the end, Jewett writes, near the woods, we could walk along to the highest point. There above the circle of pointed firs, we could look down over all the island, and could see the ocean that circled this and 100 other bits of island ground, the mainland shore and all the horizons. It gave a sudden sense of space, for nothing stopped the eye or hedged one in, that sense of liberty and space and time which great prospects always give. What a perfect definition of the spirit of Maine. Thanks for listening to Conversations from the Pointed Firs. I'm Peter Neal.
You've been tuned in to Conversations from the Pointed Firs, a Leets Island Books audio project, produced by Tricia Badger, theme by Casey Neal for Mock Turtle Music, hosted by Peter Neal. Visit pointedfirs.org for more information, and find us on your favorite podcast app.